This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This week, feature contributor Gail Dutton talks with Stephen Deeks about HIV-infected patients who were able to resist the onset of the disease. These elite controllers may hold the key to controlling and perhaps eradicating the virus. But first, staff writer Cary Grenz has a roundup from The Scientist Daily News.
G-protein-coupled receptors, which are the largest known family of proteins, might not pair up as often as scientists had thought. Charles Choi reports on thescientist.com that researchers at the University of Oxford found many pairings might instead be random interactions. Recent evidence showing bioluminescence resonance energy transfer, or BRET, has shown the receptors often pair as homodimers or heterodimers. But when Simon Davis and his colleagues experimented with varied protein expression levels, they found, quote, all proteins, even known monomeric proteins, gave substantial BRET values. Davis adds, quote, this suggested that proteins that are confined to the plasma membrane are relatively crowded, with nonspecific interactions common. The findings should prompt reevaluation of suspected dimers, but Michael Bovier at the University of Montreal says that Davis's study might have overexpressed proteins and, quote, thus favoring random collisions that may supersede the signal originating from specific dimers. Bovier said Davis's studies do not change his interpretation of previous work using BRET. The controversial findings were published in the latest issue of Nature Methods. In government news, Ted Agris reports that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has been shutting down its National Library Network. This plan includes closures at research libraries in Chicago, Dallas, and Kansas City, and reducing access to collections in New York, Boston, San Francisco, and Seattle. Last month, the EPA also closed its Office of Prevention, Pollution, and Toxic Substances Chemical Library. The shrinkage is due to the EPA's library budget dropping from $2.5 million to $500,000. Scientists and research advocates disapprove of the closures. Craig M. Schifries, director of science policy at the National Council for Science and the Environment, said, quote, cutting what appears to be a small dollar value relative to the size of the agency will have a disproportionate effect on EPA's ability to achieve its stated mission and goals. The EPA's total budget is $7.3 billion. EPA spokesperson Jessica Edmond wrote in an email to The Scientist that many holdings will be made available online. She also wrote, quote, EPA is committed to ensuring unique library materials are available to the general public, the scientific community, the legal community, and other organizations. Also in government news, the National Institutes of Health and Boston University are reevaluating the environmental impact of a new anti-terrorism lab. John Dudley Miller writes on thescientist.com that the laboratory has been under construction in Roxbury, a poor and densely populated area of Boston's South End, since March. Roxbury residents sued the agency to stop funding the laboratory, which is intended to study incurable fatal diseases like plague and Ebola. Last month, the federal district judge announced the NIH and Boston University will reassess the site and determine if a less populated area would be better. But construction on the $178 million labs will continue. The judge reasoned that if the National Emerging Infectious Disease Laboratory found a new home, the building could still be used for other work. An NIH spokesperson told The Scientist that the agency, quote, still anticipates that the Boston University NBL will contain BSL-4 laboratories.
You can find full stories of The Scientist Daily News on our website, www.thescientist.com. Next, we have excerpts from Gail Dutton's interview with Stephen Deeks for her November feature on HIV-resistant patients.
I'm Gail Dutton, reporting for The Scientist. Thank you for joining me as I talk with physician Stephen Deeks at San Francisco General Hospital. Deeks is engaged in bed-to-bench translational research. On the front line of the battle against AIDS, he works closely with a unique group of patients whose disease has not progressed in an effort to understand how their immune systems have staved off HIV. That group is divided into two cohorts, PCATs, for partial controllers on antiretroviral therapy, and elite controllers.
And we found out in this group of people that one of the major reasons they're doing well is that because the virus was crippled, the immune system worked better. So the way the HIV actually makes people sick is it attacks the immune system. So what essentially happened is that the virus became crippled, less fit, less virulent. It was no longer to attack the immune system. And the immune system itself became better able to control the virus. So by weakening the virus, the immune system took over and now is controlling the virus.
But not fully controlling
not
the virus.
Not fully, but sufficient to keep people out of trouble.
Now the danger is they still have the virus and can still spread it.
They still have the virus, they can still spread it. Joint back over with the drug-resistant virus, which can be spread to others, and that is a big problem. And also, even though the virus is weak, it's not benign. So people do progress. It just takes years and years.
Okay.
So it's not a miracle thing. It's just, but in order to prove that the immune system in these patients was working well, we had to compare it to someone else for whom we thought the immune system was also working well. And that led in 2005, to our effort to basically clone the entire Bay Area for people who were controlling their virus naturally in the absence of any drugs as a comparison group. And then we basically went out and aggressively began the search for these people who have no virus and never have had any virus.
And never had drugs to control it.
Never had drugs to control it.
Okay.
And these are the quote-unquote elite controllers who you asked about, for whom now we have also one of the two largest cohorts in the country. And we're studying very carefully those guys to figure out how the immune system works. At the same time, we're studying the PCATs. We actually have people in the cohort who were known to be HIV infected in 1978, and who now, 28 years later, have never had any measurable virus, and never had any drugs, and are basically, these are people who are very, very, very rare.
But we can, and you say never had measurable virus, you mean by standard test?
By standard test.
Okay.
But very good pickup. We think they're HIV infected. And when we go searching, right, when we take out billions and billions of cells and we do all the work we can often find it. But we're in the process of now trying to figure out whether we can find it in everybody.
Okay. When you do find it in those groups, what concentrations are you finding?
Well, one in a... I think it's about 1 in 1 in a million T cells. So the HIV lives in T cells, and about 1 in a million cells will have it. I have to confirm that.
What type of observations have you made that really did translate back to the patient?
Well, this whole we were talking about this in the meeting earlier. One observation recently was the fact that, as a consequence of the drugs reducing the fitness of the virus, we realized, and that's leading to the most of the benefit that occurs in patients who have drug-resistant virus, we realized that, that you don't need all you need then is drugs to maintain the virus in a less fit condition. So therefore, we actually began doing studies in which we peeled away. So people come in, they're struggling on a regimen of 10 drugs, and we're going, no, you don't need all those 10 drugs. You need just the drugs enough to maintain the virus in a less fit condition. And so we can wheel it down to one or two drugs. And so you can come up with these simplified ways of, quote-unquote, waiting, right? That was what we were talking about earlier, how to wait. So if you have someone who has drug resistance, you're not going to switch. You're going to keep them on a stable regimen, how to do that. And we learned when taking observations in the lab and applying in the clinic, that you can do that with fewer drugs, not more. Peel away drugs, less side effects, people are happy. That's one big area. The second big area is this whole thing about T-cell activation. Right, we've had a whole series of observations showing that one of the reasons why HIV drives disease is by causing the immune system to be inflamed. And that was this, all this inflammation, this HIV causes all these T cells to get turned on. A T cell that's turned on causes damage. It also dies quickly. So we have basically began to tease out ways to make people better by reducing the amount of inflammation.
Be sure to check out www.thescientist.com for more on the Elite Controllers, including Dutton's full feature and links to extras, including how old world monkeys are able to block HIV. You'll also find more daily news updates, web exclusives, and weekly podcast features from the November issue of The Scientist. This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.